Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Hey, we're going to read tonight from the book of Haggai as we continue our study in the Minor Prophets. The introduction is, as most Older Testament books, most prophets, they jump right into the text. Haggai chapter 1. Haggai is a prophet who has very little introduction, just like so many of them. We do have a little bit of history and corroboration with his being mentioned in both the book of Ezra and in the book of Zechariah. In fact, Zechariah takes over after Haggai writes. I want to change our view from calling them minor prophets to the more biblical later prophets. And that may make it a little easier for us to study them. They're not minor, they're not insignificant, they're just later in the writings. The beginning of the book is a citation. That is, some people are quoted as prophesying. They are saying that it's not now, it's not right, it's not the time to rebuild the temple. This is Solomon's temple that was destroyed. And now they've come back, the Jewish people have come back into the land, and they actually got started 18 years previous to this particular prophecy or speech of Haggai, but they got stalled in this. So let's give a little bit of background to who's who in this story. Darius, according to the Levitical Midrash, is the son of Ahasuerus and Esther. According to the book of Ezra, the foundations of the temple were already laid by Sheshbazzar and his company. And Ezra tells how the leaders built the altar and began sacrificing burnt offerings. But that's where they stopped. 18 years later, they're still, all they have is the foundation built and an altar. That's all they had. So why didn't they finish? Why did the Jewish people stop building? Well, most of the exiles, like we would say about modern Jews, considered their exiled home home. In other words, there was no interest in traveling to the land of Israel. It was a desert. It was a desolate. Why would you want to go home? You've already got a home, number one. They were in Babylon. They were already taken captive in 586 BC, and they had made it home. In Jeremiah 29, it says, when you go into, and this is Jeremiah prophesying to the Jewish people, saying, put your roots down. You are here, and make the best of it. Instead of always whinging that you're not in the place where you want to be, which is a verse that has helped me in so many places where I've traveled personally and where I've been stationed as a Jews for Jesus missionary, to know that God's placed me in Washington, D.C., or in Chicago, or in New York City, or in, get this, Sydney, Australia. Plant your roots, get stationed there, and make the best of it. I think that's part of what was going on in the Jewish people's minds. Also, they were reluctant to go back to Jerusalem and face the dangers in rebuilding the temple because you don't know if the new one that they build will also be captured and knocked down and they'll waste the finances that they'd accrued. So there's some practical considerations that were going on, I think, in the minds of the Jewish people. And those who did return were probably the poorer ones, rather than the richer ones.
The richer ones stay with their bill.
That's it. Why would you leave? If you got a nice home in Vaucluse, why would you get up and leave and go to Tamworth? Also, there was an unstable political situation after the death of Cyrus in 529 BC. His son reigned for 7 years. Cyrus died, and as is typical in many of the Eastern world, when the father dies, children vie for power. So one son took over, then another son took over. There was instability, and that would have led to the people of Israel saying, I'm not going to go there. There might be a coup. We might not have a calm political situation. So those were the things, I think. Also, the Samaritans who were living there at the time. Remember who the Samaritans are.
From Assyria. They plundered the tribes of Israel.
The northern tribes.
They took them back to their own country, and then they infiltrated and put them back into their own soil.
That's it. So those are the Samaritans. Jewish in the modern sense of the word. Samaritans were distinct from Judeans. Think geographically, if you will. the lower half on the map, that is basically Judea. And then the middle part would be Samaria. The northern part would be Galilee. And they were distinct regions. And you would say, ah, he's a Galilean. Like we would say, he's a Victorian or she's from WA. So they were one nation, but they were subdivided. And even regions within a section of Israel. And as a result, Samaritans who lived in what we today call the West Bank were a distinct category than the Judeans. Later on, after the temple was destroyed and Jews were chased out in 70 CE after the temple. In modern days, all Jewish people, like those of us around the table, are not necessarily from Judah or the tan part up there, but from all those peoples. So they together are now what we call Jews. The biggest problem that the returning exiles faced was the Samaritans and others who might have lived in the land. They might have helped to say, we'll build the temple, claiming they'd been sacrificing to God. But Zerubbabel and others declined the offer, insisting on doing the work themselves. By the way, Zerubbabel, Zera, seed of, Babel, the seed of or a child of Babel. Though he's really a Jewish person. So in fact, the antagonized people there in what we would call Jerusalem, the Samaritans, actually got what might be called today restraining orders to prevent the faithful Jews from following through and building. So that's when Haggai and Zechariah prophesied to the Jewish people there in the name of the God of Israel. And that's when they came on the scene. It's about 520 BC. So it is 66 years after the capture and the sending off to Babel. And so it starts in August of that year. That's what it says, on the first day of the sixth month. First month is around now, March, April. So somebody calculated it. August 29th of 520 BC, when Haggai gives his first sermon. And he's talking about stirring the people. Get up and get back to work. I don't know what took 18 years. And it's possible, if we read chapter 2 in a certain way, that Haggai might have been an old man, and therefore he might have seen the glory of the first temple. And if that be so, then I guess he was just patient during those 18 years awaiting their getting back up. 2 months after his first speech, Zechariah joins him, according to the book of Zechariah. And the situation's pretty bad. Let's read on. Inadequate money, isn't it? You earn money and it just goes right through your fingers or right out your pockets. There's housing problems, shortages, harvests that don't produce enough. It's a lack of clothes. There's a whole lot of situations. Sounds like I'm reading the Age newspaper. Sounds like I'm reading the Sydney Morning Herald. Problems in the world. It's open anywhere, and it sounds like these exact same woes. People who work hard and have nothing to show for it. Look at verse 11. There's the promise of a drought. Sounds like there's a cause to the effect of the drought. What's the cause? Well, in verse 7 and in verse 5, Haggai says to the Jewish people, consider your ways. Take a look in the mirror. Take a look at your spiritual inventory. Take a look at what you value, and you'll find that the things that you value are not what you should be valuing. We call it value or worth. What is that worth? Somebody came in and asked me yesterday. It was a funny phrase. It was a piece of jewelry. And I said, if you mean how much am I charging you for it, I'm happy to tell you that. But it struck a chord in my mind. What's it worth? And what we value is what we consider worthy. And the word worship comes more from worth-ship. In other words, what we value is what we dedicate ourselves to. So here the prophet is saying, you value things that you ought not to value. What are they? Take a look in verse number 4. Is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies desolate? In other words, here's 18 years, you've got a foundation and an altar. That's what you want for the house of God? But that's all right. You have a nice home in Double Bay. It's okay. It's not okay. And that's what he's saying. You have considered things of value that aren't as valuable as the worship of God. His chiding is going to produce good things, as every prophet does. Not a job you really want to be a Jewish prophet. Because the first thing you're going to do is tell people they're in trouble because they've sinned. Hi, I'm Bob. I'm a prophet. You're a sinner. That's how it's going to start. There's no introduction of me. There's just a declaration by me. That's the job of the prophet. prophet. And then at the end, it's going to be glory. At the end, there's going to be positive things. Why? Because the people are going to listen and they're going to do what they should. So this first message is addressed to two people, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua. That's what he's called in Ezra. Yeshua, here Yehoshua, son of Jehozadak. This is the Zerubbabel who led the Jewish people back to Judea. He's the grandson of Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, in the list of Matthew chapter 1.
What happened with the attempts of King Cambyses in bringing the exiles back? The attempts of King Cyrus bringing the exiles back with plunder? And even at the time of Queen Esther in bringing back the exiles?
That's a century later. We're looking in this story at the rebuilding of the temple, not the getting of the exiles who were planted now back in Babel to come.
So the first lot that returned, there was no temple.
Right. 586, we've lost it. 516, we get it back because they're going to do the work in just a few years. By the time of Esther, that's mid-5th century, so it's another 100 years on. And the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem comes from there, and that's 444 B.C.
How long did it take this one, of Haggai? How long did it take to rebuild and restore the temple?
They're constantly working on it, but they got it done in 4 years. That's why 516 is the common time. So Zerubbabel was an heir to David's throne, and Cyrus and Darius would allow that man to be the governor of Judea. That makes sense. Joshua, or Yeshua, is a direct descendant of Aaron, obviously, because he's a priest. And this time, he's the high priest. So the people are claiming that the time hadn't yet come for the Lord's house to be built. Exactly what lay behind this remark is uncertain. Perhaps they thought that the predicted captivity wasn't yet up, and they'd be out of God's will if they built the temple. It's only been 66 years. I think that's really the key in this first chapter. Consider your ways. And how's he going to get them to do that? First, by showing them in verse 6 their troubled situation. And then in verse 8, which is really a second speech, go to the mountains and bring wood and rebuild the temple that I may be pleased with it and be glorified. So now it's a directive. Now it's not, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we had a house for God? Now God is saying, I want a house. Get on down there and build me a house. Sometimes people need it directly told them. Some people have good intuition and pick up on sentiments or thoughts, or wouldn't it be nice if, and three people get up and go do it. Sometimes people say, well, nobody told me. Okay, then I'm telling you, go build me a house.
Would a modern day comparison now would be those who are in Manhattan, in places like America, that are not concerned for the things of God, are not concerned for what is happening in Israel, the people who are going in Israel, and then you have the government of Israel living very basically.
Look, we can interpret a whole lot of things from this. Basically, what we want to do is let the text speak straight, and then we'll make some applications. So we've got the lean harvest, and then we've got people who suffer from diseases. The wine is so watery that it didn't provide satisfaction. Clothes aren't heavy enough to keep out the cold. I mean, it's a dire situation. Then he says, go up to the mountain and get the wood, and let's get this thing started, that I may be pleased with it, and that I may get some glory, says the Lord. This is kavod, the heaviness, the glory of God, a word we'll see later on as well. You look for much, but look, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why? Because you've been more concerned about your own house than my house. And I think that's one of the things we have to ponder in application for ourselves. How am I honoring the house of God? Now, if you went to a Scottish Presbyterian in the 18th century and said, I want to talk to you about the house of God, the temple in Jerusalem, they would say, no, the house of God is right here. It's St. Giles Presbyterian or St. Andrew's Presbyterian. This is the house of God. And a modern Pentecostal, they use the phrase a lot when you go into the church. They say, aren't you glad that you're in the house today? And by that, they mean the house of God. And I appreciate that they view the house to mean the place of worship where they have assigned themselves and each other to meet together with the Lord. I appreciate that, and I think that's a suitable application. It is not the interpretation, though. It's an application. The interpretation is the house of God is the building that God ordained, which is only in Jerusalem. It's not in Edinburgh, and it's not in Baulkham Hills, is it? There's one place where God assigned his name. So a concern for God's house means a concern for the Jewish place of worship. It it's got to be that. It can't mean anything else by interpretation. It can mean a lot by application. In other words, I can take this and apply it to my life. Be careful when you apply what should be interpreted. You can make hundreds of applications. So God says in verse 10, it's your fault that there's no produce. It's your fault that there's a drought. I'm calling for it because you're not, I need to get your attention, is what he's saying. I need to get you these last 18 years, I mean these years, to get back on track what you started 18 years ago. The economic catastrophe is the price for unfaithfulness in regards to building God's house. Those three are used a lot in the prophets, aren't they? New wine, oil, and grain. Wine, these are staples in Israel. Look, you'll see that in most of the prophets. When God gets ticked off, he's going to knock out our grain supply, our wine supply, and our oil supply. And if you know the Hunter Valley or any of the Barossa Valley or any of the valleys around where wine growing happens, you'll know that they bring a lot of olives in there as well. Olive oil and wine grow in the same type of soil and same type of weather. So Zerubbabel and Joshua, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord. Just like that, you see good response in the Jewish leadership and the Jewish people. I like that. And that is what's going to preserve us from the judgment that God just announced. They obeyed the voice of the Lord their God. Now, who really spoke? But how come they heard it as the voice of the Lord their God? Mind you, Haggai's writing this. I think there was conversation about it in many circles. There would be Haggai speaking, and he spoke it to the people, but he spoke it to the leadership. And when the leadership take it on board, and they broadcast it in their, we could say, networks, then the people take that as the word of God. And it is the responsibility, as we read Jeremiah 23 and Ezekiel 34, we note that the shepherds are the ones on whom the responsibility lies. And if they don't shepherd the people, if they don't teach the people what God is saying, then they're going to cop some serious pain and problems as well. It is common within the Jewish history that prophets were knocked back. These guys we look at today as Bible writers, they're tremendous, they're holy people. But the people of the day said, yeah, I don't think so, buddy. And a lot of them were killed. And we read that in Jesus' words, that you killed the prophets. And we're a little embarrassed by that as Jews, that we killed our own prophets. Not a happy situation. But in this case, however, the people feared the Lord or showed reverence, verse 12, showed reverence for the Lord. I mean, the Hebrew is just simple yareh, feared the Lord. I don't know why we changed it in this version. I guess we're uncomfortable with the idea of fearing God. In the Septuagint, I think it's phobos. It's a hard thing to deal with in light of modern psychology, that we had a phobia of God, a deophobia, because we think all phobias are bad. But the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the Lord is healthy, where you know who God is and who you are not. And that's really good, the fear of God. He is, I'm not. That's the end of the story. That's a good story at that. Well, the people got that under control, and then look at Haggai's affirmation to them. He's now called the messenger of the Lord. That's another word for messenger. Angel. Yeah, malach. The angel of the Lord, right? So what a great title here. Spoke by the commission of the Lord to the people, saying, I'm with you, declares the Lord. That's it. What a great affirmation. All things are settled by knowing God is with us. I remember a story of a little boy who was caught in a house fire, and he was scared, and he was upstairs in his room, and everybody'd gone out, thinking that all the children had come out, and the firemen were there, and they saw this little boy up in his room. And of course, he couldn't see, and so his dad downstairs is yelling. I mean, he wanted to run in, and the firemen wouldn't allow them, the parents, to go in. And so he said, Joseph, jump out, I'll catch you. Daddy, I can't see you. And the daddy said, don't worry, Joseph, I can see you. And when I think about it, that is how we are to live. I don't have to see all things, but I know the one who does, and he can see me. And that's the affirmation that's found in Haggai 1:13. By the way, what does Haggai mean? Chag, festival. That's right. And the Yud probably was part of the typical ending of many of the prophets. Probably it's not just Yud. Probably the Yah ending, hallelujah, praise Yah, praise, so the short form of Yahweh. So it's probably Chag Yah, the festival of the Lord, or the festive God. Meaning, when you think of festivity, like we had last night with the banquet, That's pretty good. That was a festive night, and we could linger, and we could eat, and if it were a regular Jewish thing, we would have had wine, right? Imagine the more festivity. That's an idea of festivity, singing and laughing and dancing. That's the name, Chagya, I think, of Chagai. And I like that about him, because he starts with, hey, you got trouble. You didn't buy your ticket to the festivities. But then by result of their amending their lives and lining up with God's plan, everything flowed. You ever see that? I've seen it in various carnival type places and sometimes in airports. It's a machine and it's got several balls, and the balls go down certain tubes, and then it hits a bell and turns things and knocks a ball and array of cylinders and tubes, and mesmerized by it, and then it goes down along and click, click, and then the ball or some water comes out or flags, and then the balls all make their way back up to the top, and you just stand and watch this thing for a half an hour, and you say, where did my last half hour go? But when I think about it, getting all the balls in the right tube at the same time allows this machine to work. And if a ball goes off on its own, the machine stops working, because it requires all the balls to do all the things at the same time. And that's what God wants of us as well. He wants all our balls in the right row. He wants our ducks in a row. He wants all of our hearts in the right place. He wants our knees and our feet and our wallets and our hearts and our minds and our eyes to be in the right way. And if they're not, he's going to say, you know, it really would be better if you didn't. And then he'll be more directive in his second speech. But at the end, when we turn our ways towards him, he says, I'm with you. There's nothing better than the presence of God. What's the Hebrew word for presence? Well, that's the glory of God. That is true. The presence of God will be a description of the Shekhinah.
Didn't you mention that word in the benediction that you gave last night? Or did you say countenance?
But it is the same word. And what's the word? Panav. Your countenance. Panim. Faces. And when you talk about the presence of God, you're talking about two faces facing one another. It's not a face-off in some oppositional way, but very mutual adoration way. It's very personal. When you get close to somebody, you can be very close in their personal space, face to face. And I am with you. The presence of God face to face with you is absolutely terrifying if you're out of his will. It's wondrously comforting if you're in it. So the Lord, verse 14, stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. It's funny that they say the whole pedigree, and the spirit of Joshua, and the spirit of all the remnants of the people, and they came and worked on the house of the Lord of hosts, their God. That could be a great end of the story, but it gets better. That was just on the first day of the month, and now 3 weeks later, this happens, and now we go to the 21st day of the seventh month, so about 3.5 weeks later. Haggai gets another sermon that he gets to give, a short sermon, speak to Zerubbabel and to Joshua and the remnant, and say, who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory, this house? The word is bayit, not the word for temple, which we would be used to. And how do you see it now? Doesn't it seem to you like nothing in comparison? See, I think this might be a verse that allows us to say that Haggai is an old man. Because he's saying, how many of you are like me? You remember. You remember the place we used to go to? Remember the corned beef sandwiches we got across the street? You remember the big building? Gone. Let's build it back. I can draw it for you like I was there yesterday. That's the way I picture it. Now, I don't know if everybody agrees with that.
That was 70 years.
Yeah, almost 70 years before. So it makes him an 80-year-old man, probably. Or a 75-year-old dude. He's up there, which is very old in Bible day. And it's old until about the 20th century. But now, verse 4, take courage, Zerubbabel. Take courage also, and all you people of the land, take courage. Chazak, chazak, benitchazek. Just be strengthened. I love that, the way God personally communicates to the leaders. He doesn't just say, hey, all y'all, as they would say in Atlanta, Georgia. But he's saying, particularly you, Zerubbabel, though you were born as a child in Babel, you are still a member of the covenant community, and you've still got a job to do. So take courage. Get strong. Let me put that into you by my word, because faith comes by hearing. Faith comes by hearing. So when Haggai speaks this word to Zerubbabel, faith grows in him. When he speaks the word to Yeshua, faith grows in him. When he speaks to all the remnants of the people, why remnant of the people? Why not all the people? They were banished and had not yet returned. So he's speaking to almost all the Jewish people. but not all. And by that, Jewish people, I'm saying what we call today Jewish, whether Judeans or Samaritans. Why? Verse 4, for I am with you, and my spirit abides in your midst. Don't be afraid. It's a promise I made when you came out of Egypt. Verse 5, don't be afraid. This is what Moses said to the people in Exodus 14 when they stood at the sea and they were scared. Let's just do a quick look at that. Exodus chapter 14. In verse number 10, Pharaoh's drawing near. The children of Israel look and they're scared. I mean, they've got a sea in front of them. They've got Egyptians behind them. We are dead meat, right? That's what they're thinking. And so in verse 11, they yell at Moses. It says they said to Moses, but really they're yelling. What? No graves in Egypt? You make us come out here so we should die? Thanks a lot, buddy. Isn't this what we told you when we were back in Egypt? Leave us alone. See, this helps us understand that not all the Jews, not all the Hebrews there in slavery, thought that Moses, he's our man. It took a year for them to be convinced. Verse 13, Moses answers four different peoples in one fell swoop. Listen to what he says. Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he'll accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you've seen today, you'll never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. He's rebuking four different peoples, four different responses that the people had. Number one, let's dive into the water. We're dead meat. Let's kill ourselves. Suicide. By his rebuking them, saying, stand by, he's challenging them to not jump in. Number two, some others said, let's go back and serve the Egyptians. And Moses says, stand by. You'll never see those Egyptians again. Some said, let's take up the battle and beat up the Egyptians. And Moses says, the Lord will fight for you. Number four, others said, let's pray. And he said, well, you keep silent. Now you think, wait a minute, Bob, why would God rebuke us from prayer? Because these were faithless prayers. These were people who said, great, we might as well, sort of like when Elijah was battling the prophets of Baal and they wanted to cut themselves and do things to get their God's attention. That's what he's rebuking, false worship. So in one fell swoop, Moses rebukes all four categories of people and says, hang in there, God is with you. But what does he say? Do not fear. And it's that to which Haggai is alluding. So now we'll go back to Haggai. As he says this, my spirit is abiding in your midst. When you came out of Egypt, that's the promise I made you, not to fear. And but why? I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth. But that's exactly what we would do. If you and I were sitting here like they were in Christchurch last year at this time, shaking, we would be saying to each other, oh, Lord, oh, my, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? Call 000, quick, let's go run in the streets. Let's find a way of escape, right? Wouldn't we do that? Natural disasters are natural. He's not talking about natural things. He's talking about a supernatural shaking. And so you have to look now at the verse in Hebrews chapter 12. The first half of the chapter is all about discipline, and all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. But to those who are trained by it, it accomplishes stuff. So he says, strengthen one another and pursue peace with one another and don't have bad attitudes towards each other. Because, he says in verse 18, you didn't come to a mountain that can be touched, blazing fire, darkness, gloom, and whirlwind, which sounds like Mount Sinai, right? But you've come to Mount Zion, verse 22, city of the living God, heavenly Jerusalem, myriads of angels, and et cetera, et cetera. Moses said in verse 21, I'm full of fear and trembling. But look at verse 25. See to it that you don't refuse him who's speaking. For if those did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape who turn away from him who warns from heaven. Verse 26 is a quote of Haggai. And his voice shook the earth then, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. This expression, verse 27, yet once more, denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken as of created things, so that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Our God's a consuming fire. Look, we have, verse 28, a kingdom that cannot be shaken. So let's show gratitude by which we offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. What he's saying is, have discipline, have relationships that are good with one another, and at the end, when God starts shaking things, which means people start falling off the rails in our community, you keep your head when all those around you are losing theirs. And keep your focus on the one who calls us to himself. That's how chapter 12 begins. with so great a cloud of witnesses, let's keep our eyes on Yeshua. Keep our eyes on Yeshua. And at the end of the day, when the kingdoms of the world are shaking, and I'm not talking about rumbling earthquakes, though plate tectonics allows for people to preach that, but I'm talking about people who are part of kingdoms or look religious who are going off the rails, who are wacky as to be. He says, I'm going to keep shaking the earth, but you keep your eyes on the Master and you won't be shaken because you are unshakable. We would say unflappable because our eyes are on the one who's got the whole world in his hand. I think that's what Haggai is saying. When all else is going down the tubes, and we could look at the global financial crisis, which, by the way, is not anywhere close to over, no matter what our government or governments have said. Poverty is growing worldwide, not diminishing. And revolutions like the Arab Spring of last year, which lasted well into the autumn, are only going to increase. So government turmoil because people don't have. End of the day, if I don't have water and I don't have food, I'm going to demand it of somebody who does. Whether I take it by force like they do with carjackings in South Africa or whether they bomb people like they do in so many places in the Middle East. End of the day, I've got to provide for my wife and kids or myself if you're single. And that's going to cause shaking kingdoms. Yeshua and the apostles and Haggai tell us the same thing. Fix your eyes on the Master. I am with you and you'll be right. That's the application for modern days that I think the Bible is saying. If you have your eyes on Yeshua, who is the temple of God, he, not a building, he said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will build it up. And they yelled at him. What are you talking about? It took 46 years to get it the way it is. He was talking about his own body. He is the temple. So what is it for me to have paneled houses and the temples in ruin? In other words, what is it for me, this is my interpretation of this, for me to have all kinds of time to do things for myself, but I'm not thinking about the things of God? What would that make God happy? Not at all. So the argument is not about being more religious. That's not it. But about being concerned for the things of God, the people of God, the hierarchy of God. I'm not talking about apostles, prophets, and evangelists. I'm talking about the things he cares about, widows, orphans. That's what he cares about, the downtrodden, the lonely. We've got to do that. And more I'm being moved, and I'm really happy with our One New Man gatherings. Next week we'll have another. And I know that we're going to see more and more people. And I don't mind that, because if Jew and Gentile together celebrate Messiah, and we keep him as our focus, and we continue loving one another and build a community of love, that's unstoppable. It's unshakable. When all other kingdoms are shaken, he's what it's about. So I want to do that. I want to keep doing that. And it's not going to be based on religious segregation, but of messianic fervor. Well, that's what I see from this text of Haggai. I hope that you see his end as he communicates at the end of chapter 2. It's wonderfully affirming. At the end of the verse 20, the second time Haggai, so his fourth speech on the 24th day of the month of Haggai chapter 2, verse 21, speak to Zerubbabel saying, I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of the kingdoms of the nations. I will overthrow the chariots and their riders, and the horses and their riders will go down, every one, by the sword of another. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I'll take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, declares the Lord, and I'll make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.